This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm your host, Bill Radke. If you love the spray paint on Seattle buildings and walls and signs, and who doesn't, then you'll be glad to hear the city's anti-graffiti ordinance has been struck down. We'll discuss that with our panel of journalists because we are going to make you smart about what happened this week. I've got Seattle Times transportation reporter David Croman sitting feet from me. Welcome back, David.
Hi.
Freelance health journalist Joanne Silberner. Nice to see you again.
Nice to be here.
Seattle Channel host and producer Brian Callanan. Thanks for coming, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And you can stream this show and look at these lovely faces on YouTube or Facebook. Just search KUOW Public Radio. Topic number one. On this program, we grown-ups often talk climate change, right? Fires and smoke and melting glaciers and suffering wildlife. Think about how climate change looks to a child. When we're gone, our kids will probably have it worse than we do, and they're too young to vote on policies that affect them. Interesting approach this week. About a dozen young Montana residents, one as young as 5 years old, were in court suing their state for not acting on climate change. Here is 19-year-old plaintiff Grace Gibson Snyder describing the value of Montana's natural beauty.
Everyone's life in Montana is an appreciation for, and maybe even more importantly, a dependence upon the natural environment. So many people subsist upon agriculture and ranching, and so there is this super deep generational cultural connection to the outdoors, to a depth and an intensity that I haven't yet found anywhere else.
Joanne, there have been similar climate change lawsuit attempts. I think this is the first to go to trial. What is their claim here?
Well, in this case, in Montana, there's a guarantee in the Constitution to clean air and the right to live a healthful life. So they're going straight. It's a constitutional question for the state. There's a federal case that's was interrupted but is going on now in Oregon. There could be a case someday in Washington. I think there once was. And what the group that's bringing this case is talking about is there was a legislated rule to bring down greenhouse emissions. No one knows it by 2020. No one knows it's been met yet because the Department of Ecology hasn't come out with the numbers. But when those numbers come out, if the state hasn't come through or if the laws haven't come through well enough or the policies to bring down those emissions, they'll have a case here too.
And I just thought it was interesting with this one, Joanne. It seemed like specifically this lawsuit was focused on the state law that's in place in Montana that prevents agencies basically from considering the effects of greenhouse gases when they issue permits for fossil fuel development specifically. That's a new tack on this legally, and I think that's really interesting and something that I would say is a little different about Montana. That industry is a lot more grown up there than it is here in Washington.
Talking about coal?
Yeah, I mean, we've got some refineries up in Whatcom County, but other than that, that's not really an industry here at all. Yeah. And so watching that legal tack here in Montana, could it be replicated here? Maybe not exactly, but it's certainly part of this overall effort to try to legislate climate change, and that's very difficult to do.
Yeah, and it's an interesting combination because they've got climate change, they've got children's rights, and they've got human rights in there. I mean, that's what they're playing on, and I think one of the reasons they picked kids to focus on is they've got a longer lifespan technically, and they're going to be dealing with this for a lot longer than I am.
Yeah.
And the harms that they're talking about, because a plaintiff has to have standing, right, and has to be damaged in some way, to suffer in some way. So they're talking about agriculture, I think that plaintiff mentioned, fishing, wildlife, recreation, air quality, right, what you have to breathe, drought stressing people's cattle, floods eroding riverbanks. So shortened recreation season's a big deal in Montana. So these are some of the harms they're claiming. The state lawyers say that Montana's contribution to climate change is minuscule. How can you show that any one state's actions threaten directly threaten your health or livelihood in these ways.
Well, coal regulations, the regulations surrounding coal mining in Montana, that would be one way.
But can you limit that? I guess what they're trying to say, the scope of climate change, it doesn't really stop at a state's borders, I think, is a part of this.
Yeah, it's not like coal dust making you unhealthy.
Right. Well, the Oregon case is a federal one. So that'll evidently end up on Merrick Garland's desk someday. So we'll see where that goes.
Hmm. Well, what about Washington? We've got destructive fires and smoke and stressed out wildlife. Do plaintiffs have a case here?
They could, I guess, is one way to look at it. I was looking at this this week just with regard to what the Seattle City Council is working on, and they talked about this in their Public Safety Committee, just the arrival of the smoke season that's going to be coming up here. And I think everybody's heard about it. It's not going to be a good one. And so how do we honestly protect against that when we live in a city where maybe 50% of the people have an air conditioner or an air filtration system? It's difficult to do that. And so what the city's trying to do is create some sort of emergency plan, and it's a pretty sprawling one. I mean, you think about Puget Sound Clean Air Agency is going to get involved, SDOT, transportation is going to get involved, City Light's going to get involved, the Regional Homelessness Authority is going to get involved too. How do we create a plan to respond to what is a climate emergency? And I don't think we have a great answer to that just yet, and I don't think we have a great answer to these lawsuits either, but this is this intersection of where climate law comes together with local governments, and how do we figure it out? I think we're going to hopefully learn some answers in this lawsuit, but there's a lot of question marks, certainly in Seattle right now.
And I think that fire season is really jazzing things along, because all the people who can do something about it, the policymakers, are being affected as well.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that New York City and Washington, D.C. had their experience this year, well, in Philadelphia and the East Coast in general, had their experience this year with fire, you know.
From Canada.
Right.
I think you do see the difference, I think, in coverage. You know, we've had smoke seasons in Seattle and the Northwest for, you know, quite a few years at this point. And they, you know, not that they don't get any coverage, but when New York City was shrouded in smoke, it was front page in the New York Times every day, which is, you know, as it should be. But I do think that the fact that smoke has this particular power of just, it's so suffocating and it's so oppressive, and it's just all you can think about all day is what is happening in the environment right now that's making me feel so uncomfortable. And I think the fact that the kind of power centers of this country in New York City and Washington, D.C. have now experienced that, worse even than what the West Coast has experienced. Who knows if anything will lead to that from that, but I imagine that it drove home the urgency to a few more people.
Hope so.
So this is this trial's ongoing right now, and this judge, I noticed the judge in this Montana case said she could rule that state law doesn't comply with their own state constitution, but she cannot tell the legislature what to do about that. So this case is still a long way from policy, it sounds like. It's more about precedent than policy, I think.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. I think you see it here in our state, just in terms of what Labor and Industries is doing right now. They're working on crafting some policies too to make sure it's safe for workers to be outside during certain times of year. So I think it's something that all eyes are on this Montana case right now.
Right. UPS, I think, just made a deal with its drivers that they would air condition those vans, because you're out there all day driving those vans around. It's 105 degrees. It's not good.
Yeah, what can Brown breathe for you? That doesn't sound fun.
It seems like the parallel with these cases is tobacco, maybe. Mm. As far as sort of landing a blow toward on a industry and putting blame. I don't know the particulars super well of the Montana case, but I think that landing a legal blow against, you know, Shell or BP or, you know, some of the big oil companies, it's kind of the holy grail for a lot of advocates, because then it's not just you're sort of fighting climate change in the nebulous, you're actually assigning blame and demanding responsibility be taken for that. Probably. So again, sort of maybe similar to the tobacco case, maybe similar to some of the opioid litigation that's happened.
Gun manufacturing,
you know, but even on a bigger scale than that. But unlike all of those, I think you could probably show eventually that some of these oil companies knew about climate change, but whether they are responsible for it seems like that might be a taller task than even some of those other cases.
All right, so we'll watch that Montana case and see what happens in the Northwest as well. Let's turn to another topic here on KUOW's Week in Review. This is the city of Seattle, where a federal judge stopped a city from enforcing its anti-graffiti ordinance. You remember during the pandemic, 2021, police arrested four people for writing messages in chalk and charcoal on concrete blocks outside of the SPD East Precinct, such messages as F the police. And the arrested people said, well, we were targeted because of our political views. And this week, this district court judge said the city did violate their right to free expression. Brian, as you said, is it free speech meets property rights?
It sure seems like it. The quote that really jumped out at me was from Judge Peckman, who said, the criminalization of free speech significantly harms the public interest in far greater measure than the public might benefit from criminalizing property damage. And I think it's really trying to get to the message that is within these different things that are scrawled in different places, because some of the case law indicates that back in 2017, I mean, it was a situation where you had police out on the street celebrating with supporters, and they're writing "We Heart SPD" in chalk on the ground.
Right.
Shouldn't they be arrested? I mean, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the challenge with this was, at least initially, it looked like Judge Peckman was going to strike down the entire order when it comes to things that are damaged, public assets that
broken
are damaged.
Windows.
Exactly,
and
right. She's narrowed it since to just talking about the graffiti piece, but this is going to be a really interesting one to watch pan out.
But is it key whether the graffiti is in washable sidewalk chalk versus spray paint?
Not in her order. This just seems like an example of, I mean, you know, I think perhaps it was implicit in that that law that you could theoretically prosecute somebody for a chalk drawing before. But when SPD made that arrest, they made that explicit, which... You know, I think that if that those particular arrests had never been made, we would never be in this spot.
And what about kids who are out there with their sidewalk chalk? I mean, they're going to have to get in.
She wrote
she
that.
Said that.
She wrote that in her order, and she also talked about could you arrest a kid for putting a streamer on their friend's bicycle? You know, stuff like that. So
meaning to say, it's overly broad. It's overly broad legislation that's going to be. What's the word? Cherry pick, you know, enforced selectively. That's the word.
Right.
Selectively enforced.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is how the law works a lot of the time, or the legal system works a lot of the time, which is if you find you can't sort of parse out graffiti from chalk in this case, because in her reading, it was, you know, chalk and graffiti are treated the same in that. And so therefore, you know, for all I know, the judge hates graffiti or anyone might hate graffiti, the fact of that legislation encompassing something like chalk, or possibly encompassing something like chalk, means the whole thing has to go.
Right.
But why couldn't she have distinguished legally between what's washable and not washable?
Because the law doesn't say that.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I think that's
so
the whole point.
She's just
there.
Saying change the law and maybe it can be okay.
If that's what it takes. But yeah, there's really no distinction between what's written in chalk and what's written in paint. And I know that people have different feelings about each of those, but that's kind of the way the law is basically saying, don't write on something if you don't have the permission of somebody to do it. And it doesn't specify chalk's okay, spray paint, you know, the color red's not okay, you know, those sort of things.
And before 2020, you know, if we had had this discussion, you would say, well, that's crazy. Of course it means paint and not chalk, until suddenly it didn't.
Yeah.
and then you have to consider, well, maybe this lawsuit does theoretically criminalize children drawing during the 4th of July parade or whatever. And
right.
She just concluded that it is. And that's a First Amendment violation. You know, the interesting
thing. The hopscotch case.
Yeah, oh,
exactly.
Man. Take this all the way to the Supreme Court.
the interesting thing to me will be, it feels like we're going to talk about the drugs law in Seattle here in a second, but it feels a little bit like that, which is you have, you know, in the drug case, the state Supreme Court tossing out the drug statute, the state legislature putting a new one in and leaving it up to Seattle to decide how they want to codify that. You know, here's another case where if Seattle wants to recriminalize graffiti, I think they're going to have to go back and write a new law that specifies this, because as far as I know, this graffiti law is dead. You know, we know from the city council that they might not be all that eager to begin punishing graffiti people. Whereas the state, you know, the city attorney, we know because during her campaign has made a big deal out of criminalizing graffiti and cleaning
Mayor
up
graffiti. Harrell's talked about graffiti.
Yeah, yes. Mayor Harrell too.
Put some money towards it. Yeah.
So this will be kind of in some ways, a replay of what we just saw with the drug statute, which is how is the city council going to be willing to sit down and make graffiti illegal again? Or are they going to say, you know what, we think there are better ways to deal with this than arresting people for graffiti?
Sounds like a juicy campaign issue possibly later on this fall for sure. Yeah.
And people care about this stuff, you know, on one side or the other, you know, because you're talking about, you know, how they view their city. But on the other hand, you are talking about First Amendment expression. And so there's sort of a lot of emotions caught up in something as seemingly small as graffiti.
Yeah. Joanne, you're nodding.
Yeah, I think it's a mess because, graffiti. I'm one of those people who hate graffiti. I don't like being told what to look at or what is art. I have my doubts about some public art, but at least with public art, you know, statues and sculptures, I've got a little bit of a say in it, in that I'm electing officials who are presumably watching over that. In graffiti, I have no say. I feel offended. But on the other hand, I certainly want people to be able to express themselves.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, we'll see what the city's going to come up with regarding anti-graffiti. You mentioned we're going to take up this similar situation with what's the city going to do about drug possession, drug use. We'll talk about that. And on the other hand, City Hall Park opening up, reopening. But what next for City Hall Park? All that stuff is there's a taking a radio break between us and that fascinating conversation. Quick break first.
You rely on this podcast to stay informed and connected with your local community, and we rely on you. Without listener support, this show simply wouldn't exist. Be a part of the team that makes this show possible by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute. Donate at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thank you.
You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review, getting wiser all the time about what took place this week. I'm Bill Radke. You can stream the show on YouTube and Facebook. Search KUOW Public Radio. Either way, you'll be watching or listening to my panel, Seattle Channel host and producer Brian Callanan, freelance health journalist Joanne Silberner, Seattle Times transportation reporter David Croman promised you we would talk about this drug use and possession law, so let's do it. This week, Seattle's mayor said he'll work out some kind of drug use and possession law that can pass the city council.
We will pass a law that allows our department to make arrests. I'm unambiguous on that. But we will do that with compassion to protect people when we have to.
So last week, the council rejected a law that would have let the city prosecute people for having and publicly using drugs. Mayor Harrell said he does not want to repeat a hurtful, unfair war on drugs. He wants to send nonviolent people to drug treatment and therapy. But we've been discussing that goal for a long time. So why is all this just happening now?
I think it's just centered around the city council vote and what it really means, and specifically what happens on July 1st when this new law goes into effect at the state level with that Blake bill that we've been talking about over the past several weeks here. But that quote-unquote fix to our state's drug possession law has made drug possession, drug use, public drug use into a gross misdemeanor. So misdemeanors are generally the purview of municipal courts, and that's where the city attorney would get involved, et cetera. And so usually it isn't as much of a big show. I mean, state laws pass and the cities codify them, and that's the way it goes. In this case, however, I think there is so much concern over, okay, we're having these officers make arrests. What then? Is that court system the best place to put people who are dealing with drugs? Do we have enough of these treatment or service systems in place such that people can be diverted to them and deal with these so we don't have to fill up our jails, et cetera? So I think that July 1st date is something that a lot of people have their eye on. Will we have a lot of answers by July 1st? I'm not quite sure.
And isn't that why the city legislation didn't pass? It was concerned among those who voted against it that we didn't have things in place that would take care of people.
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. The city also recently pulled out, the city attorney's office recently pulled out of this community court system that could have potentially been an avenue for people who are there on low-level drug charges to go into different services or whatever.
And why did they do that?
Because it wasn't working, at least from the city attorney's perspective. Basically, 22% of the people who went in there actually, quote-unquote, graduated, but a lot of people did not. So Ann Davison was very concerned about that, wanted to make sure that there was a better threshold, I guess, for some of those services and diversions that were going on. And it's just, I guess, what I see happening potentially July 1st is maybe bits and pieces of this might be in place. Maybe we will actually have this actual law on the books or what have you, but these other portions of it, meaning, okay, what does a different reaction or program for the municipal court look like? What do these services look like over here? How are we going to link those things? I feel like those systems are still a little ways off, but we could be potentially very close to a city council vote. I know a lot of people are eager to make that happen.
And it's a particularly unique situation to Seattle because you were talking about the different, you know, most major cities in the country don't even have a city attorney. Most places have just basically our equivalent to the King County prosecuting attorney. So, you know, if this were Philadelphia, for example, it would all fall to Larry Krasner. But here we have two attorneys with overlapping jurisdictions in the King County prosecuting attorney and the city attorney's office. But
and the King County prosecutor says, we don't have the resources to
bandwidth.
Right, because, I mean, one slight correction to Mayor Hurl's comments, you know, the Seattle Police Department can arrest people right now for drug possession.
It's still illegal.
The question is what happens on the other side. And the King County prosecuting attorney said, you know, her office doesn't have the bandwidth to take these up. So we're not going to do it. And so therefore and the city attorney's office said, you know, we want to do it. We just need the authority to. And so that's kind of where we are. You know, from a political standpoint, I think this is kind of this is sort of a silver platter in some ways for Mayor Harrell, because it gives him the opportunity to do exactly what his kind of, you know, his One Seattle campaign. You know, this is a perfect opportunity for Mayor Harrell to look like he's coming in and sort of bringing everyone together and finding a solution that balances, you know, law enforcement with treatment. If, of course, that is what ends up happening.
Yeah. What would be new about him riding in with a solution? We've been saying for how long that we do already divert people, right? Mm-hmm. We have pathways out of the incarceration system to get into treatment, et cetera, therapies. So what's brought us to the moment now where it seems like Mayor Harrell's going to solve?
I didn't say solve. I said politically.
Politically,
he may get a bill passed that says nothing of what happens after the bill is passed. Which is, you know, the big problem is treatment. That there is just not very much of it. And what is there is, I think people think of treatment as this. You know, you go to treatment, you come back, and you're treated. That is not at all what happens. It usually takes several times, and it's not an A to B. Progress. It usually is A to X with several stops in between. So it's really complicated and it's really expensive and it doesn't really exist as things stand right now.
I think what's really interesting this time around is words that actually bring fear to my heart, a 24-member work group. You know, that he's called in everybody. He's called in the police chief, the fire chief, REACH, Purpose, Dignity, Action, NAACP. He's city council members on both sides of the issue. If he can pull this off, I think it'll be really impressive. He's got everyone at the table this time.
He's got people at the table, but it is going to be the proof in the pudding. And like I said earlier, I feel like this is something that's going to roll out in pieces. He had mentioned that the city council can't do this in a week, so we're going to have to wait at least a little bit to see what happens from that very narrow legal side of it. Okay, what sort of ordinance is the city going to pass? But then those other parts of how is the court involved? And I think it's an important piece of this. When the city council was considering this legislation, they cannot compel the city attorney's office to do a specific thing. There's a separation of powers there. So in crafting this legislation, they're trying to be careful about that. They're trying to urge the use of these different diversion types of services, whatever else, but they can't necessarily compel the city attorney to do that. And I think that's a bit of the conflict here too.
And then I think even if a bill does make it to the city council, it's still a pretty good chance it's going to be a 5-4 vote, because there are members of the city council who just fundamentally don't believe that a gross misdemeanor is the right way to go. And so they're not going to endorse any sort of tactic that allows drug users. And we should be clear, we're talking about drug users here, not drug dealers, because mm-hmm. Those are likely to be felonies. So, you know, a few members of the council are just going to always going to oppose codifying a gross misdemeanor for drug use into the state code. I think a lot of this is going to come down to what Councilmember Andrew Lewis wants to do, because he was the swing vote on the last one. He said publicly he decided at the last second to vote against it. And his reason was he wasn't sure what was actually in place to help people who are going to be funneled through the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
There's new money coming in, isn't there, from that vote for a tax increase?
If you're talking about the crisis care centers levy, that could be potentially one. And actually, the mayor brought that up in his press conference. But I'm interested to see what happens with that on the county level, because that's a walk-in type of system, and anybody can go there. Police could potentially bring people there that they're dealing with. But I look at that and I think about, okay, when are these actually going to come online? Yeah. That's not going to happen tomorrow either, right? Yeah. So I'm hopeful that those things, that there is some urgency to that, that they'll come online quickly. But I do know, just from citing just about anything that has even a shred of controversy around Western Washington, that's not going to be easy.
You know what came online this week? City Hall Park. Seattle reopened that park by the county courthouse. It closed a couple of years ago after a bunch of violent assaults. This is the voice of Gavin Muller, who works at the courthouse and is glad to have his lunch spot back.
It's been kind of a bummer that it's been fenced off. This is kind of my one spot, like, to go, like, eat lunch, not inside the courthouse. I hope that it stays open. I hope that it's a good environment for people to hang out at.
A good environment for people to hang out at. David, what's the city going to do to keep the park a good environment for people to hang out at?
Well, as I understand it, they're going to have kind of a more consistent ranger presence there with a direct line to the police department. They're also, you know, we've seen this with other parks in the city. I think of Westlake or Occidental Park. They take on this activation approach, which is a terrible word, but basically means you have sort of positive activities like
table tennis, bands,
and table tennis and food trucks, and you try and infuse a park with as much positivity as you can, so that it's welcoming to all sorts of people, and therefore welcoming to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Concerts.
They have mm-hmm. tried that a bit with City Hall Park, though, in the past, and as far as I can tell, that hasn't worked. You know, I think it's part of the reason it became what it was, with such a large encampment. I think around the beginning of the pandemic, the city stopped clearing encampments for the most part, in part on a CDC recommendation to do so. Mayor Harrell has shown that he is perfectly willing to clear out encampments, and with help from a lot of service outreach and things like that. We saw it at Ballard Commons and the Woodland Park, I guess.
Yep.
And so, you know, I think what it'll look like, I'm not saying this will work, but I think what it'll look like is some combination of enforcement, outreach, and, just a lot of food trucks.
And I think, too, the unified care team is another piece of this. The mayor's touted that quite a bit. So when encampments potentially do show up or whatever else, there are services right on hand, right at the time, to respond to that quickly. And David, you brought up Ballard Commons, which I think is another good example of this. The park in Ballard there that closed down during the pandemic due to similar concerns. Dozens of tents in that park area there. They've cleaned that out. That's been open since March. Looks like it's going okay so far. And I think it's following the same kind of idea of activation, et cetera. And I think now that we are just about beyond the pandemic, I never want to say that for fear that we're going to get this new mm-hmm. awful variant as if we hadn't had enough already. But it feels like being beyond the pandemic as we are, I'm hopeful that these places will activate themselves, I guess, and people will start to engage with them, because I really do think that is the answer. An active park is one that is healthy, because a lot of people are going there and people don't necessarily feel comfortable sleeping there, et cetera.
Well, what about sleeping, for example? What is the policy going to be? I mean, it's a public park.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's not illegal to be homeless.
Doze in the park? Yeah.
It's not illegal to be homeless. We have seen that the city has exercised its power to prevent encampments from being in other parks, again, like Woodland Park, like Ballard Park, Ballard Commons, excuse me. So I think there will be probably some strong arming a bit to prevent people from sleeping there.
Go ahead.
In addition to kind of what Brian was saying around the pandemic, one thing that I think was a little underappreciated, you know, there's a lot of reporting around it, but when the pandemic happened, tons of services shut down.
Yeah.
And a lot of in-person help that people could have sought out basically disappeared. And if you're, you know, homeless and living on the street, your access to Zoom is perhaps not as good as for office workers. And so I think that, you know, when you talk to service providers, they talk a lot about how much of an impact that had on their ability to maintain current relationships with people that they work with and build new relationships. And so, you know, if there's some reason for hope, it's that I think a lot of those services are opening back up again and are a little more available. So that would be another aspect that would be working in favor of this being a lasting solution that wasn't maybe available a couple years ago.
But the challenge, I think, is going to be to get people to come back. I think people are sort of fed up. You know, we've had a number of recent murders that I think are spooking people. Mm. And it's really, you know, the idea that we have to get people walking through and making it a living place rather than a overnight place is going to take effort from all of us.
Yeah. Big part of the downtown activation plan that the mayor is working on right now. This is a piece of it. And I have to say, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on City Hall Park because, as you'll remember, originally it was looking like the county was going to take it over and make it part of its campus. And now the city's doing it. So I think there's going to be scrutiny at a lot of different levels to make sure they get this right.
Yeah. Okay. And there won't be the police are not going to be making drug arrests there. They could, but they're not going to, right? Because no one's going to prosecute them.
And I don't know that they were before.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
For
yeah,
strict
okay.
possession cases.
Yeah, for strict. They were for dealing and trafficking, but not strict.
But they shut possession. That park down. Now it's open, and we're just sort of wondering what life is going to be like in that park.
Yeah.
Okay. One more thing before we take a break. We're here with KUOW's Week in Review. We got a couple other news issues to talk about, but did you all hear we're getting a new area code?
No.
Yeah.
I saw that this morning.
Yeah. So what? Just a quick note here. Once they're out of the 206 numbers, they're going to run out in the next year or two. Before that happens, they're going to start assigning the area code 564 to, you know, Seattle, Vashon, whoever gets a 206 now, which is going to play into the snobbery of who's lived here the longest.
I'm going to sell my 206.
Yeah. Highest bidder.
Can you sell your number?
I don't think so.
Probably not.
Well, let's find a way.
Yeah. When I lived in L.A., the city people didn't want the suburban 818 from the Valley.
It.
The downtown people didn't want the snobby 310 from Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
They're keeping it real with the 213, and so we're going to get... By the way, I found, as I was looking around about this, did you know that our area code has its own song?
No.
Not about Seattle. It's about your skeleton.
I got bones. I got bones.
Bones.
When I count my bones, I get 206. I got
bones. Uh-huh. I got you now. Okay.
When I count my bones, I get 206.
Yeah, the adult human skeleton. 206 bones.
Now we know.
So I don't know what there's 564 of, but someone's going to get the 564 here.
We'll work on that song for next week.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Should we take a break? That was just too good. I gotta relax.
Calm down.
Then we're going to get back to, we're going to talk about what's going on with our commute, and while you're commuting, you might see a sign that might make you think of disease or sex or the Titanic. Stay tuned.
I got bones. I got bones.
Okay.
When I count my bones, I get 206. I got bones. I got bones. When I count my bones, I get.
It's KUOW's Week in Review, still happening, still streaming on YouTube and Facebook. Just search KUOW Public Radio. We have health journalist Joanne Silberner, Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan, the Seattle Times' David Croman, and I'm Bill Radke. You know, when workers return to the office, they also return to the roads. The cars and the buses. King County Metro says there were 45,000 more rides last month than the May before that. Metro official Katie Chalmers says a big part of that is Amazon.
When they began to make plans for this return to office, they were really working with us and making sure that Metro was ready, and we are. We're ready. Many of our routes still have plenty of room to have more riders on.
Amazon recently told about 55,000 corporate employees to return to the office at least 3 days a week, David. But is this an Amazon effect, transportation reporter David Croman, or does Amazon just get a lot of attention?
No, I think for May, it is an Amazon effect. I mean, it's on top of a growth that was already happening. Metro said they were seeing about 15% year-over-year growth each month. I think April was a little bit bigger, but then May was a 22% year-over-year growth. So that's, you know, maybe it doesn't sound like a lot, but that's another 10,000 rides on top of the growth they were already seeing. That's pretty significant. Actually, the more illuminating statistic I thought was 68 van pools were organized just for May through King County Metro, which is the highest they've ever had since the highest they've had since 2005. Because about apparently of their 800 or so van pools, about a third of them are Amazon employees. Mm. So for whatever reason, van pool is very popular among people commuting from the east side.
And a company can't rent out a county van, right? It's just whoever signs up for a van that's on your route.
Well, it's like if you get enough people, then you can create your own van pool route via King County Metro.
Yeah.
Well, Microsoft has its own. I've seen them around.
Microsoft Connect. Does have its own.
Amazon does not.
No, Amazon does not. They have all the delivery trucks out there, but not the commuter trucks. So I do think that Amazon Amazon's return is clearly making a difference. In fact, right after we published a story on this, we saw some data for early June, and the growth was kind of back to what it was pre-Amazon coming back to the office, which isn't to say they lost ridership, but as far as the percentage of growth, it looked like it had kind of gone back a little bit to earth. So that suggests that the addition of those 55,000 people really did fill the buses. And we see it in other statistics too. INRIX, which is a locally based traffic analytics firm, they do stuff nationally, but they said that traffic was 35% slower, particularly on I-90 and 520, which they called the Amazon effect. Downtown Seattle Association said that they saw more foot traffic in May than they had since, you know, February of 2020, especially around Denny Triangle near Amazon. And you don't, you know, if you go down to the Amazon campus, because the Seattle Times building is kind of right on the edge of the Amazon campus, so I have a pretty good view into it. You know, there's lines down the block at food trucks, and it was the only time I have been in a Seattle neighborhood in the last 3 years and thought, you know, this feels like 2019 or pre-pandemic. It's legitimately pretty crowded down there.
I like the Amazon vanpool idea because they could just like drop off packages on the way to work.
Deliver me to work.
Here we go. Yeah.
If you don't pay for Prime, then you take a little longer.
There you go. Right. Good point. Yeah, you don't get to use the carpool lane. Yeah. No, and just dovetailing on that, David, I thought it was interesting to see these metrics we're talking about from the Downtown Seattle Association. Foot traffic is up. The visitors are up. The number of visitors is up. Hotel room demand is up. Occupied apartment units. So is it at that space right now where it's completely all pre-pandemic? No. A number of those measures are getting close. The one that's still sticky is that whole office occupancy thing.
Yeah.
And it's right at about that 50% mark right now compared to pre-pandemic. It's rising. I mean, the trends are going up there, but it's certainly not, you know, snap of the fingers back to where it was. And I think that's one a lot of people are keeping an eye on.
Which for me is kind of the big question facing transit agencies, because when they look at off-peak hours, which means you know, middle of the day, like night times, weekends, times considered, you know, outside of rush hour, if you take all that, they're basically back to where they were pre-pandemic. In fact, in some ways higher. Where they're not at all back to normal is those commuter hours. And so much of our system was built around getting people into the office. I've done a few stories in the last few months on the Sounder, which is the train that goes from Lakewood to Seattle and then up to Edmonds. And that to me is the kind of purest distillation of the state of commuters, because it doesn't run except for during commuter hours, really. And that is still at 30% of pre-pandemic ridership. It's just not seeing that come back. And so it puts transit agencies in this kind of interesting situation where they're doing something that in some ways they wanted to do for a long time, which was de-emphasize peak hours and grow service outside of commuter hours. But it's just happened so quickly and suddenly that now they kind of have to decide, you know, where do we lean? Do we work really hard to win those commuters back and spend a bunch of money doing so? Or do we think about transforming our whole system so that it's not built around those commuter hours nearly as much as it used to be, and, you know, try and convince people to ride the bus in other times of day and, you know, go to the restaurant on a bus instead of driving there and that sort of thing. So it's a very interesting turning point right now for transit agencies.
Well, and if parking spaces keep disappearing, we're going to have no choice.
Yeah, well, Sound Transit just decided to spend $350 million building parking garages near the Sounder, which is an interesting choice because, as we just talked about, People aren't riding it right now. So that's a $350 million bet that eventually people will again. And, you know, that exudes a certain amount of confidence, but it's also not entirely clear that people will, in fact, start commuting on transit again.
Yeah, not there yet.
I, by the way, I've been reading a conspiracy theory in the comment section of your newspaper, David.
That I don't know that's a good
always
idea.
A good idea, yes.
Oh, it's a pit. The theory is that Amazon is telling workers to return to the office so that they can fire people who complain instead of having to lay them off with severance.
Oh, boy.
Do you want to debunk that or confirm that?
Yeah, I don't understand the logic on that. I can't follow that argument very well. Why would that allow them to fire?
Because, you know, Amazon has been laying people off, and so here they can just make the job less desirable, and the people who are on the bubble, on the margins, are just going to drop away.
I think that's a little too cute for Amazon. I think they are fully prepared and capable of laying people off without an excuse.
Yeah, and they're just in a better position right now than the workers are. I mean, that's, you know, these are jobs that are in demand and layoffs are happening, so that's a piece of it.
Well, and that's why people, I think, are being told to come back to the office, is because the workers just don't have the leverage that they did a couple years ago. There's just not the same level of hiring.
Yeah.
One bus question I'm meaning to ask you. Okay. Are bus agencies okay with passengers standing? Because my Sound Transit bus is now, you know, standing room only every day, every morning and evening. It seems a little less safe to me. I'm a stander anyway, but are they designed to be to have standards in them? I mean,
yeah,
like the train,
they've got the handles.
They got the straps, but the train is theoretically not going to lurch and slam on its brakes when there's an accident right in front of it, right? That it feels a little less safe to me to be where I can fly around the coach. But is that a non-issue? Like, you're going to stand?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's before the pandemic, it was almost every bus you were standing. Yeah. So if it was a problem, they'd have to buy a lot more buses and hire a lot more people.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about, so you're commuting, you're on the bus, you're headed back to the office, you are near Boren and Yesler, or you're near the Seattle Center, and you see an intriguing billboard. Health reporter Joanne Silberner, when is gonorrhea like an iceberg? What's going on with these billboards?
Oh, man.
Well, they're trying to bring attention to gonorrhea, and there's been a slow increase. Actually, what happened was there was a big increase about 10 years ago. Now the increase has slowed, but it's a group devoted to helping people with AIDS to try and get people aware of gonorrhea as a sexually transmitted disease, and you've got to watch out for that. But actually,
the billboard says drug-resistant gonorrhea. Is that something that's really on the rise?
Not according to the health department. It is on the rise in small numbers, but the drug resistance is to a drug called I have to look at this up to make sure that I get this right. It's against one drug, but it is still sensitive to another drug. So the health department itself is not all up in arms about this. They're actually most concerned about syphilis. And when I was talking to them, I learned something that I didn't know, which was that a few years ago, or actually just this past November, they were asking that all sexually active women 45 and under to be tested for syphilis. I had no I missed that one completely. They cited a fivefold increase in syphilis in women since 2015. That's the bigger problem that they see. So the folks who put up the gonorrhea board, they're concerned about gonorrhea within the AIDS community. And it's
well, what's
a problem
the connection issue. Between gonorrhea and AIDS?
Well, the same things that will get you AIDS will get you gonorrhea.
Yeah.
And also,
if you have gonorrhea or if you have AIDS, you're much more prone to infection.
Right. And let's say you have gonorrhea, you leave it untreated, sores, et cetera. That can also make it easier for HIV to enter the body.
Right.
I think that's a piece of it as well. But
yeah.
I got to say, in doing some research about this, and, you know, you start Googling gonorrhea, you get all sorts of crazy emails coming away. So thank you, Bill, for bringing this up. Yeah, it's been nice. But I think it's a public awareness campaign, mainly to okay, if maybe the antibiotics are doing all right, but if we don't have the whole concept of sexual health working in tandem with that, then yeah, then it could turn into a larger problem. But I was shocked by seeing these billboards too. But that's what it was meant to do. So
yeah, and
clearly
I think
it got people's attention.
You know, gonorrhea, syphilis, anything that brings attention to these treatable diseases, preventable diseases, is a good thing.
Yeah, this is, well, it seems to be working because it's on in the Seattle Times, and now here we
there
are
you
talking
go. We're
about
talking
it.
We're talking about it. Yeah, so it's a good thing.
I think it is also a bit of a, I don't know if symptoms probably not the right word, but symptom of a larger issue, which is that, at least as far as I understand, I don't know what the trends are lately. Maybe you know, Joanne, but in the first couple of years of the pandemic, there were some notable increases in other STDs. You know, we also saw things like decline of vaccination rates for things like measles and mumps. And so I think there was kind of a larger trend of because public health departments were so laser focused on COVID and devoting all of their resources to COVID, we lost a little bit of ground on some of these other diseases. And so, you know, it seems like maybe this is kind of part of an effort to pick up the ball where we left it before.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right, now you know, in case you've seen these billboards with the freighter hitting the iceberg. And speaking of freighter, by the way, it's timed. We're near the end of the show. We've got about 5 minutes left. And I don't know if you were exactly smiling about this, Brian, but you told me the story of a freighter mishap that turned into a sculpture that turned into a mystery.
Yeah, mystery sculpture. Yeah. Good old Rolf Nestlund.
The Seattle Times again. Told
Seattle Times
story.
Was talking about this, and there's this rogue sculpture that showed up in West Seattle where I happen to live. And so this was the captain who actually ran his boat into the West Seattle Bridge, causing a long-term closure many, many years ago. And infamous guy was ended up being dismembered by his wife. It's a pretty grisly story, but I think, West Seattle being the resilient folks that they are, someone put together this statue of his bespectacled head kind of on the trail that goes right around the Pigeon Point neighborhood. It's very, very close to the West Seattle Bridge. And I was just biking by there the other day, and I hate to say it, but someone had already put like a little graffiti on it. Like they just started writing on it. Like, come on. Rolf Nestlund, it's a bit of a throwback in West Seattle's history, but it's an infamous name that I think many people are going to remember for a long time. And the plaque they put on this thing was actually well-crafted. I hope that it's able to stick around with a little bit of a smile on our faces thinking about it.
Well, and wasn't he credited with bringing the
that's right.
The new bridge.
The high bridge was because of him.
Yeah. I was going to say, had Rolf Nestlund never existed, it's possible we never would have had to shut down West Seattle for a couple years.
Wouldn't it have been better if they had a bridge that worked for its whole lifespan? Just throwing it out
there.
All right. Aye, Captain. I'm going to contribute that KUW has this podcast called 10,000 Things, which is about objects that tell us something about Asian American life. And the latest episode's about our voices. And we meet a writer and podcaster named Alice Wong, who speaks using a text-to-speech app because of medical issues, and she really misses her natural voice.
It was such an expression of my snarkiness, bitchiness, and humor. My razor-sharp wit comes out clearly and quickly through my speech. Alas, I cannot do this anymore, although if people look at me, they'll see my facial expressions and know exactly what I'm feeling, but it's still not the same.
So lately, Alice Wong has been advocating for diversity and the rights of people with disabilities, and she says we just need more diverse kinds of voices on the radio.
Ideas of what is considered a good voice gatekeep marginalized people, making them feel they can't take up space and sound. And the reality is there is space and sound for all of us.
So the host of this series is Xinyi Pai, who's also Seattle's civic poet. And I'm telling you, every podcast should be hosted by a poet. I love the way she chooses words. I do that series about words in your Week in Review podcast feed called Words in Review, but I am no poet. And I think you'll like this podcast, 10,000 Things with Xinyi Pai, wherever you get your podcasts, or you can find out more at KUOW.org/podcasts. That makes me smile. What else is making you smile this week?
Well, for me, it was actually talking to Andrea Rogers at our Children's Trust, which is the law firm that is bringing the case in Montana because she was just so excited.
This is the kids suing over climate change.
And she was just so excited about the idea and it moving along in the courts and the importance of what was going on and just loving her job. It was just that really made me smile.
Yeah, that's one of the nice things about being a journalist is interviewing people, dedicated people who know a lot and just get fired up.
Yeah, and I'm always amazed that because of a lot of being a journalist is just asking people to do stuff for you and to take time out of their day to talk to you when they don't have any obligation to do so. And I'm amazed at how often people agree to do it. And yeah, I agree. That makes me smile also.
I had to throw one more in there, Bill, just because it's coming up this weekend, the Solstice Parade.
Oh, yes.
Huge fan. And if you really want to look at a fun website, solsticecyclist.org. Okay.
Uh-oh.
I think you know
what I'm saying. Is that safe for work?
No, it's kind of safe for work, but it's got this frequently asked questions section.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even know that I was supposed to ask those questions.
Yeah.
didn't even know what I didn't know. Yeah,
you can't not know that.
No, now I know too much.
So you're going as an observer.
We'll see how this goes. I don't know if there's enough paint out there.
Whoa. Okay.
All right. Tell us the story next time we see you. Seattle Channel host and producer Brian Cowan. I'm good to see you.
Thanks for being here. Or thanks for having me, Bill.
Of course. Freelance health journalist Joanne Silberner. Thank you, Joanne. Seattle Times transportation reporter David Croman. Thank you, David.
Thanks so much.
And you know, Week in Review happens because of the support we get from subscribing contributors. We'd kind of like to do more of this kind of work for you, so make this show happen by donating to KUOW. Thank you to our producer, Kevin Kniestad, and for social media and live streaming expertise, Juan Pablo Chiquiza and Tio Popescu. Thank you for Bernard Ouellette running the board, making it sound great. I'm Bill Radke, and I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll be with us another time and maybe make it a real habit. Hope to see you again next week on Week in Review.